This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. On this segment of the program, it's employment law, and we're going to be talking about some recent court decisions, including a new EEOC, Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, update, which you may be very interested about, that came out actually today. My guests are employment attorneys, employment law attorneys, Anthony Onsidi. Anthony, or Tony, as I call him, has been a great, let's say, a great supporter of this program and all of you who listen to at least this station and public radio. He's a partner of and the head of the California Labor and Employment Group at the law firm of Proskauer Rose, which is an international law firm. He's in Los Angeles. He represents employers and managers in all types of employment matters and provides his clients with advice and counseling and litigation services. He's a former member of the executive committee of the State Bar's Labor and Employment Section, is a longtime contributing author to that organization's publication, the California Labor and Employment Law Review. And as I said before, he's been a guest on this program many, many times. My other guest is Lisa Mackey. She's the president-elect of Consumer Attorneys Association of Los Angeles. She's also a vice president of Consumer Attorneys of California. Her law offices are in Los Angeles also. Funding for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar of California. Additional funding is provided by the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, the Family Law Section of the State Bar, and the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco. Lisa and Tony, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Oh, good.
Thanks, Chuck.
Oh, good. I hear both of you. This is wonderful. This is wonderful. The age of electronics. Wonderful to have you here. There is something. I was sent an email today with respect to a recent movement of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission regarding the use of criminal records. I wonder if you would talk about that a bit, because I think it's a rather important thing.
Sure. Let me dive in, and then
please,
Lisa, feel free to interrupt. The EEOC has been concerned about this issue for some time, and basically, what it is that most employers today do some form of background check on applicants. And with the rise of the internet and the basically universal availability of this information, which wasn't even true 10, 15 years ago. Many employers are screening applicants based upon any number of factors, including their criminal backgrounds. And if they've been convicted of a crime, some employers will disqualify or view to be as disqualified an applicant who has a criminal conviction, especially if it's a felony. What the EEOC has said is that there should be some connection, some job relatedness associated with a disqualification from a job. So if you happen to be applying to be, somebody who's working, say, in the mailroom of a company, and it turns out that you've got a number of convictions or a conviction for something completely unrelated to mail fraud, or embezzlement, and it had nothing to do with the job that you're being considered for, the EEOC would ask the employers to analyze carefully whether or not that is an appropriate basis for excluding an applicant. If, on the other hand, you're applying to be a person who will be handling funds or finances for a company and you have an embezzlement conviction in your background, then that is job-related, and the EEOC would presumably approve of that kind of restriction.
Let me ask you this. How would a prospective employee who may have some criminal record, how would he or she ever know if the employer had eliminated them because of the conviction? And let's say it doesn't have anything to do with embezzlement of funds or something that is directly related to the type of job. Lisa, what comments do you have about that?
I think what the EEOC said today was, these kind of job denials, they have to be shown to be job related and consistent with business necessity, as Tony was just speaking about. And so, how would they know? Well, if you're a member of one of these protected classes and you're not hired, you could bring that type of claim against the employer and find out. But I mean, generally, you're not going to really know.
Yeah.
Until possibly that claim is bought. But I think, you know, the EEOC came out very strong today saying that, you know, job denials such as these are illegal. And obviously the reason for that is because the, you know, two protected classes affected, you know, there's such a high rate in those areas. And so that's why they came out the way they did today.
Yeah, what I would add to that, Chuck, is that there's a separate statute called the Fair Credit Reporting Act, which employers are obligated to comply with, and that is they can't even do a background check on you without first notifying you that they're going to do that. So and that's both state law and federal law. So there's a lot of regulation already with respect to that. So it's unlikely that an employer would do a background investigation on somebody without letting them know. Because, for example, there could be a case of mistaken identity. Somebody could have the same name as somebody else. You know, if you're Bill Jones, you may be a different Bill Jones than the one who has the conviction. And that's precisely the reason why, Chuck, employers are obligated to say, gee, we're disqualifying you from this job because of the following record. And that gives the employee then or the applicant an opportunity to dispute that information and say, that's not me, that's my cousin, and let me prove it to you. So
okay.
It's unlikely that it's going to happen sort of randomly without the employee ever knowing.
All right. Well, very good. What about this? What about there is a problem? We had a chance, the three of us, to talk a little bit, obviously, before the program went on the air, and that is about misclassification of employees, independent contractors versus employees. What's the situation? What are the problems that employees and employers and independent contractors may be facing with this confusion or misclassification?
Well, I think in our practice here, we see a huge number of people that are misclassified, where the employer says, oh, no, you're an independent contractor, you're not an employee, and since you're not an employee, we are not going to provide you with workers' compensation insurance. We're not going to pay any employment tax. You know what? Because you're an independent contractor, well, golly gee, we're not going to pay overtime. You know, what are you talking about? You don't need a break. You're an independent contractor. And so we see a lot of these claims. What we see employers doing, and I hope they're listening, because it's a very serious problem. And the reason it is because if you are found to be misclassifying employees, it's possible that you could be criminally indicted for doing so, because you're not paying for workers' compensation insurance. And then if someone gets hurt at work, then they don't have the coverage. They'll come after you. That could result in audits and things of that nature. There is a new law that came out this year. It's in the labor code, which gives a little bit more teeth to employees when they're pursuing employers for misclassifying them as independent contractors, and that's Labor Code Section 226.8. And it does a host of things, but one of the things that it does is it actually starts fining the employers anywhere from $5,000 up to $15,000 per violation. So that means per employee. And then there's all sorts of other legal remedies that fall within that. And
is that a criminal statute or not, Lisa?
That it's not a criminal statute per se, but in the labor code, you know, there are grounds for criminal prosecution.
So the fine or the penalties or fines you're talking about, is that they are upheld by whatever the whether it's a court or whatever, are those fines, do those fines then go to the employee, or does that go to the government?
Well, it depends on which route they take. For example, if they hire an attorney or if they pursue the case on their own, these are actually penalties that would go to them.
I see.
You know, depending on if they go, for example, to the labor commissioner, the analysis would be a little bit different. But the penalties for a pattern or practice type of misclassification, which we see all the time, they can go up to between 10 and 25 per violation.
Ten and 25,000, is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Yes. And, you know, the crazy thing about it is that we see, you know, pretty large companies doing this. And I think, you know, for a long time, and probably this is the case now, is there, you know, there wasn't the emphasis on getting these tax dollars back, because really what's happening is, you know, people like me and Tony and his law firm, you know, we pay, we have employees, we don't misclassify, we're paying our share of taxes, while these other employees, other employers are not, and that hurts everybody, and it also hurts the employees as well.
what I would just jump in on this is that I think why there is, Chuck, probably a lot of employment relationships that are mischaracterized as independent contractor relationships is it's not always just the employer that does this. It's a conspiracy, oftentimes a silent conspiracy between the employee and the employer. There's a benefit sometimes to an employee.
Let me come back to that for just a moment when you bring up conspiracy, because I'd like you to talk a little bit more about that, but I want to just break just very, very briefly. All right, sure. It's our Call a Lawyer night, and we have a number of attorneys here who would like to talk with you, workers' compensation law. We have Rich Kirby, former judge, Workers' Compensation Appeals Board. We have estate planning. We have criminal law, family law, legal malpractice law, landlord-tenant law, employment law, tax law, real estate, and the number to call, 1-800-525-9917, 1-800-525-9917. No obligation on your part. It's completely confidential. It's a great public service that these attorneys are performing. This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. We're doing employment law and talking about some recent court decisions, as well as a very recent decision by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. That's the federal commission. My guests are employment law attorneys, very experienced, very successful down in the Los Angeles area, Lisa Mackey and Tony Ancidi. Let me come back to you for a moment, if you would, Tony, on this. You're talking about a conspiracy between the employer and the employee who might be characterized as, or would like to be characterized as, an independent contractor. Tell us what's going on here.
Sure, and maybe conspiracy is too strong a word. It sounds a little bit more nefarious than what it really is. But what I meant by that is that there's some advantage to an employee, potentially, as well, to be characterized as an independent contractor. The most important one is that an independent contractor typically doesn't have any withholding taken out of his or her paycheck. And so they get the full amount of whatever pay they're supposed to get from the employer, and it's without any withholding for Social Security or for state or federal taxes. And many employees obviously would like to have that situation. They will then get a 1099 issued to them at the end of the year, which is what a company would do with a true independent contractor. So and then it's up to the employee to pay taxes as they see fit to pay those taxes. So oftentimes what happens is that both the employer and the employee see advantages, and these are just some of them, there are others as well, to characterizing the relationship or mischaracterizing the relationship as a contractor relationship. The silent third party that gets upset by this, as you might imagine, is the government, because if there isn't withholding being paid and there aren't matching funds being paid by the employer, then the state, local, and federal government tend to get upset about that, and that's where you end up in an audit situation similar to the one that Lisa was talking about.
Well, isn't it correct that if you are an independent contractor that there is no deduction, for example, for Social Security, or am I wrong about that?
That's correct. That's correct. And there's also how these cases often come to my attention, at least, and Lisa may have a different experience, is the person who's been characterized as an independent contractor, when the job ends, goes and files for unemployment. And the EDE says, I don't know who you are.
And nothing.
We have no record of your having ever been employed there.
Yeah.
And so that's when the EDD often launches an investigation to figure out if these people have been mischaracterized as independent contractors.
I would also be concerned in that kind of a situation if someone who should really be characterized as an employee but is actually being paid as an independent contractor with no deductions, including withholding tax, I would be very concerned that person wouldn't have enough funds at the end of the year at the time of filing the tax return to pay taxes, which the employee, or pardon me, this person would have to pay.
Correct.
You're absolutely right. And I think when this new legislation came out and the amendments to the labor code, There was a lot of press on this underground economy, which includes this misclassification issue, and also all the employers that are paying their employees in cash under the table. Sometimes we see them paying for overtime in cash, but it's paid at straight time. And it costs us, and that means everyone who's paying taxes, you know, tax-paying companies, everybody else, it's costing our state $7 billion a year in lost tax revenue. So, you know, I'm glad, and I think, you know, I hope more people come forward and, you know, and bring these issues to the attention of a lawyer, the government, or what have you, because the estimates are if everyone paid their fair share, we'd see a reduction of 25% in our taxes. It's just overlooked. I mean, it's, you know, unfortunately, it comes down to consumer attorneys to bring these types of claims, because it's just something that, you know, our state has not gone after, and I hope they do, because it will decrease everybody's taxes.
Let me ask you a very practical thing. If someone who should be characterized as an employee believes that the employer is taking advantage of this by characterizing this person as an independent contractor because the employer will not have to pay for workers' compensation, insurance, etc., what recommendation do you have for the employee who's in that, for the person who's characterized as an independent contractor who's concerned about this? What should that person practically do if he or she is also concerned, gee, I can't afford to pay an attorney? What should they do?
Well, there's a lot of attorneys that work on a contingency fee.
Okay.
So they don't have to pay them, and that attorney would take out a percentage of the total amount recovered. That person can also contact the labor commissioner to make a claim there, the labor board, and they can just Google that. And the other option, too, is to complain to the employer and say, wait a minute, you know, I think I'm an employee. I'm here every day, you know, along with everybody else, and, you know, I want you to classify me as employee. But the problem with that, people are afraid to complain. And
they're afraid of retaliation, are they not?
And they get fired,
yeah.
And then, you know, then they're calling calling an attorney. And so, you know, but it's a serious problem, and it's you know, the other thing, you're not putting into your Social Security, so when you retire, you know, there you go. What do you have?
You got nothing, or very little.
One thing I wanted to point out, and this is on the Labor Commissioner's website, too, and, you know, there's case law on this. Even if you sign an agreement with the employer saying, I am an independent contractor, and you agree to it, it doesn't mean you are.
Yes.
I mean, there's case law on that, so we'll see that, too.
Yes.
And, you know, I tell people, and I believe this, you know, an independent contractor is someone like your accountant. You know, you call him or her, they do a specific task, and they're done. And a lot of employers also don't know. They're supposed to register every single independent contractor with the EDD, and most people don't even know that, and they don't do that. And the reason they probably don't is because they can fly under the radar and make all the other tax-paying companies and workers pay for these taxes while they're, you know, profiting at the hands of the people that are acting legally. So it is a big issue, and, you know, I hope people, you know, understand that, and they can research the Employment Development Department website or contact the Labor Commissioner to find out, you know, more. There's different tests on their website.
And this is simple to Google on the Internet, is it not?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, very good. I want to take another brief break. It is also our Call a Lawyer night. I'm wondering, do we see anybody on the phones? Is anybody on the phones? Tell me. Yeah, they are on the phones. All right, four people are on the phones. We have a total of eight attorneys here in the areas of tax law, real estate, employment law, landlord-tenant law, legal malpractice law, family law, criminal law, estate planning, trust, and probate law, and workers' compensation law. Please, if you have a question, a comment, or something in any one of those areas, please call 1-800-525-9917, 1-800-525-9917. No obligation on your part whatsoever. This is a monthly thing we do. It's a great volunteer task that these attorneys have. And they want to do it, and they want to talk to you. So please call. And in a few minutes, if you're with us on the live program. You can call in and talk to my guests on the air, and that's 1-415-841-4134. 1-415-841-4134. We have a few minutes left in our statewide version of the program, and there's a new case that, frankly, I'm a little confused with, and I don't, frankly, understand it that well. It's Brinker Restaurant Corporation versus Superior Court that deals with meal and rest breaks, and I find it confusing, at least with a little bit that I know, although I am not an employment lawyer, as you know. But what... Tony, what comments do you have about this?
Sure. This was a very much anticipated opinion from the California Supreme Court. There was much drama associated with the length of time that the court considered the case. I believe it first went up to the Supreme Court back in September or October of 2008, so it's about 3.5 years that it's been pending. And the reason why it was so... keenly watched by so many lawyers on both sides of the fence, both the plaintiffs and the defendants' lawyers, is that it was to decide a major issue, and that is whether or not employees who are supposed to be taking lunch and meal breaks during their shifts, whether the employer's obligation is to simply make the lunch break available, so a so-called provide standard, or whether alternatively the employers are required to ensure that employees take the break. And this was an interesting case. The lead case in this situation involved restaurant workers. And as you might imagine, people who get paid tips often tend to prefer not to take time off the floor because it diminishes their pay. And the employer, at least, took the position in this case that, gee, these a lot of these employees... may not be taking their lunch breaks. We make them available to them, but they don't take them because it's an incursion into their compensation. On the other hand, employees in other work environments may say that my employer prevented me from taking my lunch break, or I knew I would be retaliated against if I insisted on my rights to take a meal break. So what and why this all makes a difference, whether it's the provide standard or the insure standard, is that these are almost always brought as class actions, and it's much harder for an employee class action to proceed if the standard that is applied is the provide standard, because every employee is going to have a different explanation as to why he or she didn't take their break. If, on the other hand, the standard is the employer is required to ensure by policy that every employee takes the break, it's much easier to get the case qualified as a or certified, rather, as a class action. So the plaintiff's lawyers were hoping that it would be an insure standard. The defense lawyers were hoping it would be a provide standard. The, at least that's that part of the opinion. The employers prevailed, and the Supreme Court basically said that it's sufficient for the employer to make that meal period available, and it doesn't have the obligation to police the workplace to make sure that employees actually take the break.
Okay, well, that seems to make sense, does it not?
I'm sure Lisa will disagree.
Lisa, what do you think?
I guess, you know, after all that waiting, you know, and then reading 65 pages, the 65 or so page decision, you know, I was kind of left saying, what? You know, it's funny to hear some of the press on it. The employer's like, we have a victory, and, you know, the employee rights folks are saying, we have a victory because... you know, what we believe and what I think the decision did is actually the Supreme Court, you know, described several affirmative steps an employer has to do to comply with California's meal break requirements. And a lot of, you know, there were a lot of the decision had to deal with the class action and the certification issues, which, you know, I found very interesting. But just for purposes of this discussion, I mean, employer still has to relieve an employee of all duty. And it has to relinquish control over its employees' activities, and also it has to permit employees a reasonable opportunity to take an uninterrupted 30-minute meal break.
But Lisa, if I may interrupt for a moment, if the employee chooses not to do so, the employer has no power, legally anyway, to force that person to do so, right?
No, I don't think you can force anyone to do anything. But yeah. I think if I see, you know, for example, if, you know, in my office, you know, if someone is supposed to be on a lunch break and they're not, you know, I think they should tell them that. And there's different ways you can make sure that people are taking lunch breaks.
How do you do it? What do you do?
Well, you have policies where you can't eat at your desk. Like, you have to...
You can or cannot? Area. You can or cannot?
You cannot.
Okay.
You know, you can't sit and eat at your desk. You have to go to the, you know, the lunchroom. You have to, you know, you have to get out of the office. You have to do X, Y, Z. Because otherwise, I tend to agree, you can't really police people.
No.
It's difficult. And especially with, you know, a large company, you can't. But you can have people punch in and punch out for real, not the altered records that we see a lot where everybody happens to punch in and out at the same time.
Oh, come on now. You don't mean they're altered records, do you?
Well, they're, you know, I know, believe it or not, it happens a lot.
I bet it does.
You know, it's important. Everyone needs a break. I mean, it's crazy to me that, you know, people are more productive if they have a break. You have to get away, you know,
It's true, and I'm a crusty old defense lawyer. But
you're not old at all. You're not old. What are you talking about?
But
go ahead.
With crusty, how's that?
You're crusty. You're very crusty.
But you know, some employers do push the
envelope
on this, and they do you know, expect employees to either shorten their breaks or don't take them at all. And I think this is a wake-up call, as Lisa says, for employers to
I hope so.
Recognize that that's not an appropriate way of governing the workforce.
I hope it is. I hope it is something that employees will benefit from. What I want to do, we are coming to the end of the statewide version of the program, and I want to ask you a couple of things as we continue into the second half hour. But what I want to do is let everybody know that if you have some questions, if you want some pamphlets from the State Bar of California, whether it's labor and employment law or any of the other pamphlets, there are a great number of pamphlets. They're all free from the State Bar. You can go to the website, www.calbar.ca.gov, find out what pamphlet you would like, and the State Bar will send it to you. Also, by the way, we did mention earlier in the program that if you've been unable to pay your income taxes, by the way, next week, that's the topic. We're going to talk about people who have not paid their taxes, have not been able to. We're going to talk about the IRS collection for delinquent taxes and taxpayers' offers in compromise. Okay, it is about 7:28 and a half at 91.7, your local public radio station, KLW in San Francisco. This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. We're doing our Call a Lawyer night. I see that we do have 9 attorneys here for Call a Lawyer. Everybody is here. So let me tell you who they are. And then, by the way, I want to give you our number for the program on the air if you'd like to talk with my guests, who are two very well-known, very experienced attorneys, certainly in Southern California. Tony Onsidi, who's, I'll tell you more about him, and Lisa Mackey, I'll tell you more about her in just a couple of minutes. But our number here, in case you'd like to ask a question, make a comment, talk with us on the air, is 1-415-841-4134. 1-415-841-4134. We also have Call a Lawyer Night, and that number is 1-800-525-9917, 1-800-525-9917. Here's who we have for these various areas. For workers' compensation law, former judge of the Workers' Compensation Appeals Board, Rich Kirby. Estate planning and trust and probate law, certified specialist Colleen McAvoy, who's been a guest on this program several times. Criminal law, Jeff Hayden, who's a certified specialist, has also been on the program many times. Family law, Janet Frankel, also a certified specialist and been a guest on the program. Legal malpractice law, Peter Fortune, a certified specialist. Landlord-tenant law, Mark Branco. Employment law, John Brown. Tax law, real estate, Frank Adam. Patent, aviation, lemon law, Ron Rohde. And tomorrow, if the creditors are chasing you, and you'd like to find out a little bit about what bankruptcy might do for you, Leon Baer, who's a certified specialist in bankruptcy law, will be available between 8:30 and 11:30 a.m. tomorrow, Thursday, April 26th, at 800 800-477-3111. 800-477-3111. If you call and you get his recording, leave your name and phone number and he will call you. All right. For those of you who may not have tuned in earlier in the program, my guests are very noteworthy persons. Anthony Onsidi, he's a partner in an international law firm. He's also the head of the California Labor and Employment Group at the law firm Proskauer Rose in Los Angeles. He represents employers and managers in all types of employment matters. He's a regular good guy, by the way, and he's been a very great supporter of this program and what we are doing for many years. Former member of the Executive Committee of the State Bar's Labor and Employment Law Section. My other guest is Lisa Mackey. This is her first time on the program. She's president-elect of the Consumer Attorneys Association of Los Angeles. She's a vice president of Consumer Attorneys of California. Her offices are in Los Angeles. And some years ago, the Consumer Attorneys of California was a funder of this program. And I'm not soliciting more funding, but we've had a very good relationship. It's been a number of years, by the way, but a very good relationship with Consumer Attorneys of California. All right, here's a question that was brought into the studio. And again, I want to encourage those of you who are listening to the program, if you have an employment law question, please join us. Don't be bashful. I don't want to have you call in the last 5 minutes of the program because then it's too late. So again, 1-415-841-4134. And here's the question. What about a caregiver who does light chores and errands for an elderly person 2 days a week? Is the caregiver an independent contractor or an employee? Question mark. She gets paid in cash at the end of each day. No taxes are taken out. Now, I want to give a disclaimer here. This is a question asking for specific legal advice, and the State Bar's ethics rules don't permit my guests to give specific legal advice. However, if you, Lisa, and you, Tony, might have some comments for this person to kind of give some direction, I would appreciate your giving your comments. But what do you have to say?
Well, generally, generally with the, you know, some of, with respect to the home, I guess, home health care, you know, caregiver, if that person has other jobs. So, for example, I believe it's a she or he or she is also helping other people. That person may be an independent contractor, but there's, you know, there's also the issue of the cash payment. I don't know if the employer has registered that person as an independent contractor with the EDD. It doesn't sound like that's happened. You know, so those are things that I would definitely look at.
So if there is a regular relationship, even though it may be for a few hours a day, for a couple of times a week, a couple of days a week, the employer or the person paying this caregiver has the responsibility of contacting the Employment Development Department and registering that person or at least letting them know that this person comes to my home a couple of times a week. Is that right?
Yes, actually, if anyone, and it's on the website for the Labor Commissioner, there's an actual form that you're supposed to fill out for anyone that you're during the whole year that you're paying as an independent contractor if you pay that person more than $600.
I see. And what's the point, Lisa, what's the point of this if you as the person, the elder person or whoever it is who's receiving this caregiver services, what's the point of this if you do not have an obligation to withhold taxes or to contribute to Social Security? What's the point of registering with the EDD?
Well, because it's the law. And
well, I understand that, but I mean, practically speaking, what is the benefit for the person who's the caregiver?
The benefit is so that the EDD can make sure that they are properly classified.
I see.
And so they,
I see. Okay.
You know, quite frankly, so they can make sure that all the taxes are being paid.
Yeah, and that. Yeah. I agree. Each of these instances is going to be factually different. I mean, there are some people who may be caregivers for a number of different individuals, and they're going to be more like an independent contractor. There's a series of multi-part tests, Chuck, for determining if somebody's an independent contractor or not, none of which are really all that elucidating in and of themselves. But, you know, some of the ways to think about it are whether or not somebody has more than one client, whether they supply their own tools and equipment, mm-hmm. whether they are being supervised in terms of the performance of their job duties. You know, depending on where you fall on those kinds of questions, mm-hmm. you either will or will not be an independent contractor.
Is there any on the EDD website or the Labor Commissioner's website? Is there information that would help someone to determine whether or not that person would be considered an independent contractor versus an employee?
Yes, and actually, they can go to www.edd.ca.gov or just type in Employment Development Department Independent Contractor.
Okay.
Report is on their website, and you know, obviously, if you're sending out a 1099, you're supposed to also file that form. And
okay.
So,
all right. Well, very good. Thank you very much for that information. Let's take a first call. David, welcome to your legal. It's John. Is this John? Oh, he dropped. Okay. Well, thanks for the communication there, everybody. Tell me who's waiting to talk on the air, because I'd like to know who that is. And okay, Stuart, welcome to your legal rights.
Yeah.
All right, go ahead.
I have a question regarding breaks, but not especially lunch breaks, but what is one's an employee's rights regarding personal breaks during the day?
What does that mean? When you say personal breaks, you mean like you got to go to the bathroom, Stuart?
Or to make a personal phone call or to take a breath of air? I mean, is there...
Okay, so in other words, besides taking a break, which an employer is required or which you're permitted to have, maybe you need to get a breath of fresh air to be able to be more effective during the day, or you need to make a personal phone call. That's a good thing. What comments do you have? What flexibility does an employee have to be able to do that?
Tony, did you want to address that?
Yeah, you can go ahead.
In general, let's say you've got, you know, a regular 8-hour workday. Employers are required to give you 2 10-minute breaks. You know, insofar as it's practical during the middle of each work period. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's the general law. There's, you know, all this, you know, talk about exactly when that occurs, but you know, employees are they get breaks, and you mm-hmm. get two for a regular workday. You get 2 10-minute breaks.
Mm. Plus, you
those
get
those are on the clock. They get those are paid breaks. So in other words, not unlike the mm-hmm. meal period where you're supposed to clock out. Mm-hmm. For these breaks, they are actually paid by the employer.
So this is in addition to your taking a lunch break. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay.
That's correct. And if the employer is found not to do so, the employee, for example, in a case, would get an additional hour of pay for that workday.
Mm.
You know, in a case that might be brought.
That's interesting. That's very interesting, Stuart. With this in mind, are you telling us that you don't get these additional 2 10-minute breaks during the day?
That's right.
And you are not.
I didn't know it. Yes, and I was just wondering about the legality of it. I'm guessing that
Are you being hassled by the employer because you might want to make a phone call during the day?
Somewhat. Sometimes.
Really? Well, how long is the phone call that you want to make?
Oh, just a couple of minutes or so.
And you're being hassled about.
I don't know if I have the right.
You're being hassled about that? A 2-minute phone call?
Uh huh.
Really? I find that amazing.
You have the right, and employers are actually supposed to post.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
That tell you that you have the right, and there's all sorts of postings that I'm not sure what kind of workplace you're in, but they're, you know, they have to let you know of your right as well. And so I don't know if that's something that's not going on, but you do have the right. The employer has to post it as well.
Yeah, you should look, Stuart. You should look in the lunchroom, usually where the employer puts it, and then they've got usually a poster board with all of the required postings. And by the way, if the employer doesn't do that, that's a separate and independent violation.
Is this a small employer, Stuart?
It is. It's a small company.
How many people work there?
Four of us total.
Only four of you? Okay. Well, now the employer still has to post the posting that you mentioned, even though there are only four employees, Lisa and Tony?
Yeah,
I do. That,
okay.
That is
all right.
Right.
Who should, Stuart, don't tell us who you're working for, but where? What city?
I'm on the peninsula.
On the peninsula. Uh-huh. You're being as vague as possible, are you not? Yeah. Well, why don't you call the Labor Department, you know, and talk with them about this, because it sounds to me like you're being abused. How long have you been working for this employer?
Oh, a number of years.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
They,
I don't really feel abused, but I just wanted to know if that's
okay.
Right.
All right. Well, thank you for calling. I hope this is of some help to you, although it sounds like you're somewhat intimidated by your employer.
Uh-huh.
Aren't
exactly.
You? Yeah, okay. I got my answer. All right. Thanks for calling, Stuart.
Thank you.
Take care. All right. Now, do I understand that David is back? Do I understand that? Is that true or not? No? Okay. All right.
Elusive, this David.
Oh, brother. Okay.
Well, Chuck, for a minute there, we can also tell you.
Let me interrupt Tony for just a minute.
Good resource.
Tony, hold on. Tony, hold on for just a minute. I want to give the phone number again for the Call a Lawyer lawyers. 1-800-525-9917. I see one lawyer walking around. I want to see the lawyer with a phone in the hand. 1-800-525-9917 for our attorneys. Workers' compensation, estate planning, criminal law, family law, legal malpractice law, landlord-tenant law, employment law, tax law, real estate, patent law, aviation. You've got an opportunity to talk to lawyers. No obligation on your part. It's a great public service. 1-800-525-9917. Tony, back to you. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, no problem. What I was going to say is that there's a very good website, which I think Lisa's already mentioned, and that is the Labor Commissioner's website in California. The actual website is www.dir.ca.gov /DLSE, and that's got a lot of the orders and requirements that Lisa and I have been talking about.
Would you mind repeating that again?
Sure. It's www.dir.ca.gov/DLSE.
DLSE, okay.
Which stands for the Division of Labor Standards Enforcement.
Yeah, well, hopefully that's of help to you. And Stuart, I suggest that you take a look at that and see what might be helpful to you. Ari, welcome to Your Legal Rights. I hope you're there.
I'm here.
Hey, this is terrific. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay, cool. So my question is about I choose to employ citizens of California who are not documented. And I understand that there are about 9 million of them in the state. Considering that this is my choice, I understand that there's some risks that come with that. How do I best protect my workers?
How do you best do what?
How do I best protect my workers? For instance, how do I make sure that they receive benefits from the taxes that are paying? How do I make sure that they are qualified to be covered by workers' comp?
So you're saying, Ari, let me make sure I understand this. Are you saying that some of your workers are undocumented?
I'm saying that I make a choice to employ undocumented.
Okay, all right.
Workers.
So the issue is, are you withholding taxes for them?
I have done both. I do give them the option.
Mm-hmm.
They usually choose not to because they don't like the paperwork.
Okay.
It's complicated, but there's always an option for them to be on payroll.
I see.
Their problem with payroll is that they don't really receive any of the benefits that their taxes... they receive some of the benefits that are general taxes.
Yeah.
But they can't file unemployment. Some of the employment law rights that come with being on payroll, not applicable to them.
And also from the standpoint of, I presume you're saying from the standpoint of Social Security, if you were to contribute something for them to Social Security, I think what you are saying is they're never going to see it. Is that right?
That's exactly right. I mean, some of the people that work for me have contributed thousands and thousands of dollars to Social Security, and they'll never see it.
What comment? I know this is a very explosive question, frankly, because we have this problem certainly in this state, in this country. But do you, Tony, or you, Lisa, have any comments for Ari?
I certainly do, and I represent a lot of undocumented workers, and there are a lot of undocumented workers in California.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm of the opinion if we didn't have them, our state would collapse.
Mm-hmm.
What we see sometimes is that the undocumented workers will have a fake social security number, so everything's going into payroll.
Mm.
And like Ari was saying, is the money's going into the taxing authority, so they're getting the money. The employees are not getting the benefit of that. Interestingly enough, undocumented workers have rights. So, for example, if someone terminates an undocumented worker because they're complaining about, for example, sexual harassment, we see that a lot, they still have the right, they still have rights to be free from harassment, discrimination, all those kind of things. They generally don't have the right to something that we call front pay. So, for example, if someone's terminated and they're undocumented, you know, unless the employer maybe is yourself who knows they're undocumented, in your case, they may be able to get front pay if there's any kind of lawsuit.
What does that mean? What does that mean, Lisa, by front pay? I don't understand.
Front pay is like lost income. So let's say,
oh, I see.
Hypothetically, you discriminate. They say, and then someone sues you, and you say, "Oh my gosh, you're undocumented." They'll say, "Well, you knew about it."
Oh, I see.
So I get my, you know, in that case, you could be held liable.
I see. Okay.
So I can't comment on the legality of employing undocumented workers or not. But the one thing really that I see all the time, and this also comes with the cash payments and the like, and with undocumented workers who are quite often in very high-risk industries where they're injured a lot, and, you know, because they're doing all the hard work that, you know, quite frankly, some of our citizens refuse to do, but that's a topic for another day, they get injured a lot. And so but you can still cover them under workers' compensation. And so, you know, it sounds like you are doing that, and that's a good thing because, you know, that's...
Yeah, I think it's a wonderful, wonderful thing that worker compensation can actually cover the undocumented people who work here.
That's not what Lisa said, Ari. That's not what Lisa said, though.
They do. They actually allow you to cover.
Okay.
Workers who are not documented, as long as you provide them with the information that they need to have.
Mm-hmm.
It's complicated because it's complicated, but the workers' comp, at least the state compensation insurance fund, provide that, and I think it's a fantastic human rights right.
So, Ari, you are finding then you are contributing to you're paying for coverage of workers' compensation for some of these people. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah. And when they are injured, if they are injured, are you finding that the insurance company, whatever it is, the workers' compensation insurance company, is properly dealing with them and providing care and paying for care or not? Are you finding any problems there?
Well, that's a great mystery. Thank God I have never had
good
to deal with it.
Okay. Well, I'm glad to hear that. All right. Well, anything else that comes up?
Yeah, I just want to mention that the reason why I brought this question in this public forum is because I think that the bigger issue is the issue of immigration policy. And
no question.
And I think it's an incredibly hot and unattended to issue that creates a great deal of suffering for a lot of people.
No question about it. Thank you very much for calling.
Thank you.
I'm glad you did. Call a lawyer is 1-800-525-9917. We have 9 attorneys here, and tomorrow, if you're being hounded by creditors, We've got Leon Baer, a certified specialist in bankruptcy law, who will be able to talk with you between 8:30 and 11:30 a.m. That's tomorrow, Thursday, April 26th. If you'd like to call him, it's 1-800-477-3111, 1-800-477-3111. If you get his voicemail machine, please leave your name and phone number. He will call you back. And if you'd like to speak to any of the other Call a Lawyer lawyers, it's 1-800-525-9917. If you'd like to speak to my guests on the air, Lisa Mackey and Tony Onsidi, it's 1-415-841-4134. Too many numbers. 1-415-841-4134. If you have a legal problem, you may need to talk to a lawyer. The Bar Association of San Francisco's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange an appointment for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. This is a public service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, and for a referral to a lawyer, call 415-989-1616. That's 415-989-1616. This information is brought to you by the Bar Association of San Francisco and KALW listeners like you. If you're in San Mateo County, the San Mateo County Bar Association also has a lawyer referral service. You can call your own at 650-369-4149, 650-369-4149. If you're in any other county in California, every county has a bar association and lawyer referral service. You can call your own during normal business hours. Tell them what the problem is. They'll do their best to find someone who's experienced and set you up for a half-an-hour consultation. Depending on the county, for a half-an-hour consultation, it could be a low of $25, perhaps a high of $35. That's pretty much the general charge throughout the state. And, Eric, welcome to your legal rights.
Somebody just asked a similar question, but I have a slightly different query. I'm a homeowner, so I have homeowner's insurance, and I occasionally employ people to do gardening and stuff like that. So I know the homeowner's insurance would cover me for workers' comp. But what are the legalities of hiring somebody, you know, who just off the street? Who is it legal to not contribute to, I don't know, withhold taxes and Social Security, or even if they're just a day laborer, I should suppose?
Well, are you talking about someone who would just work for you occasionally, or are you talking about someone
no.
who... Pardon?
Just for a day or something.
For a day. Okay, so what is your obligation then? You're saying that you have to withhold tax, withholding tax and perhaps contribute something for workers' comp or what?
Yeah, that's the question.
Okay.
Is someone in my position obligated to do that? And also, what if they don't have a Social Security number?
Well, all right. That's very good questions. Any comments by you, Lisa or Tony?
I would say that the immigration laws would prohibit that. I don't think there's a day laborer exception. However, I think the risks are quite minimal unless you're going to run for office anytime soon.
Oh,
we've all seen a number of
candidates
get into trouble on this issue where they have. People who've helped at the house or who are caretakers of some sort or another and who are not legal and for whom there have not been Social Security taxes paid and other kinds of taxes. But I think it's a fairly minimal risk. Obviously, I wouldn't advocate anybody not following the law, but for a day laborer, I don't think it's going to be that big of a risk.
Lisa, any comments?
Yeah, and just, same, and that also, make sure you look at your homeowner's policy carefully.
Yeah.
And what's covered and what's not.
Yeah. Yeah, because some homeowner's policies have express exclusions for employment-related claims. What that's really intended to do is prevent you from submitting a claim for wrongful termination or discrimination or harassment. But I think it probably makes sense to make sure you understand either by talking to your insurance company or your insurance broker, exactly what kind of coverage you do have for people who work on the premises.
I think one of the things that concerns me, for example, and this may not be something, Eric, that you're concerned about, but for example, if you have a tree or trees on your property that need to be trimmed and you decide to hire somebody who may not be a licensed contractor in California, I think you run the risk of not being covered by your homeowner's insurance with respect to any injury that may occur. And I think that's very dangerous. Lisa, I realize this is probably something that Lisa and Tony, you're not aware of, but certainly in my research of this, it is a problem. And I think a lot of people are trying to cut corners by hiring people who, in the normal course of events, should be licensed contractors but are not. Do either of you have any comments about this?
I actually recently had a trial, and this is, you know, this is what I kind of find, you know, I don't know, it's not even laughable, but, you know, huge licensed contractors working on gigantic public works projects and having all undocumented workers, you know,
yeah.
not paying them overtime, paying them cash, and, you know, and the like. And, yeah, you can hire a licensed contractor, but there's no guarantee that, you know, the employees of that contractor are undocumented or not, but certainly, you know, you run a risk that if the person isn't licensed,
mm-hmm.
You know, there could be issues. And, you know, gosh, what, you know, God forbid someone gets killed,
yeah.
you know, doing some manual labor, then what?
Yeah, yeah.
I had a case recently where it was a company that had a subcontractor that was doing cleaning for the company, and there was a suspicion that perhaps the cleaning company was employing undocumented workers. These were not employees of the company, my client, but just potentially undocumented workers for the subcontractor. And the way it ended up coming to litigation was that there was an employee of the company who said he was a whistleblower.
Mm-hmm.
What he said is, I complained about the fact that the company retained a contractor that retained undocumented employees. And then I was fired. The company's position is that it had nothing to do with the termination, but that's what lawsuits are made of, as
of course.
I both well know.
Yeah.
And that's the issue of the day, whether that was really their motivation or not. Of course, we think there's no evidence of that, but it certainly exposed them to a potential lawsuit based upon those allegations.
All right. Eric, I don't know if Eric's still here. Does that help you?
It does. I really appreciate the suggestion of talking to the insurance agent,
because
I don't understand the policy myself. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much for calling, Eric. All right. Let me again mention Call a Lawyer Night. We still have the attorneys here. They're still conscious, believe it or not. They're looking forward to talking to you. 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. And I would want to alert you, for those of you who haven't been able to pay your income taxes, next week we visit income tax again. The IRS collection for delinquent taxes and taxpayers' office offers in compromise. I'll have John McGregor, who's a certified specialist in taxation law, and Dennis Bean, who's a CPA. I want to thank you both for joining us. It's been a pleasure, Lisa, to have you on the program.
Thank you for having us.
I hope you enjoyed it. And,
yes.
And Tony, as you know, I'm always in awe of you.
Oh, thank you so much. Feeling is mutual.
Yeah, right, thanks. Anthony on CD, former member of the Executive Committee of the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar. He represents employers in the international law firm of Proskauer Rose. His office is in Los Angeles. And Lisa Mackey, very nice to have you on the program. She's the president-elect of the Consumer Attorneys Association of Los Angeles and a vice president of Consumer Attorneys of California. Her offices are also in Los Angeles. Thanks so much. Your Legal Rights production staff members are program engineer Joanne Marr and production assistant Martin McLean. Funding for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar. Additional funding is provided by the Trusts and Estates Section of the State Bar, the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, the California Applicants Attorneys Association, and the San Mateo County Bar Association. Thank you very much for joining us on Your Legal Rights. I hope you join us next week when we will revisit taxes. I'm Chuck Finney.